Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan. And for this episode, I'm joined by Cisco DeVries. He's the Chief Executive Officer of Ohm Connect, which has been a highly successful, innovative demand response program in California that's now spreading across the country. Before that, Cisco was very involved with PACE financing. We'll talk about that and his time at Renew Financial. Just delighted to have Cisco on the show today. Cisco, greetings. Welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. How are you today?
I'm excellent, Ted. It is great to see you again.
Good to see you. It's been a while. It's been a whole pandemic ago.
Right. I figure it's kind of, we've lost track of time. It's like a furlong of time. I have no idea exactly how long, but it's been a while.
We've all been through a really, really unusual experience. I'm glad that we're largely out of it. What's your focus today before we get into the conversation? What are you focusing on?
You know, I've got two things I'm focusing on today. The first is I ran a half marathon yesterday, and I wasn't really trained up for it. And I'm, you know, so walking today is actually one of my big focus. I'm just being able to get up and get down is fine. From a work perspective, which is probably more what you had in mind, you know, I've been spending a lot of time, as we'll talk about Ohm Connect, helping figure out how we help people reduce their energy bills, energy management services. Like, so going from where we've been focused, where I've been focused about occasional energy reductions for the grid, to how do we get people's bills lower? How do we consistently help them use less or use less energy at the right time? So energy management more holistically has been the thing I'm focused on for this week. And it's a kind of exciting task.
That's a great topic. You know, when I ran a demand response program years ago for PG&E in downtown San Francisco, obviously we wanted to be able to have the greatest reduction from their usage down to whatever the firm service level was. And so people had already reduced through energy efficiency, in a way you're working against yourself, right?
Well, you know, a fun thing to get into, because you're absolutely right. And what we've found is that so Ohm Connect, which I'm sure we'll get a little more into, we help people reduce their energy use at peak times, and we pay them for those reductions, demand response. What we've found is our customers are reducing their energy use by 5 to 10% on average overall. And that's actually quite negative for our demand response business, right? Because that just cuts into the amount they can reduce at peak. But it turns out to be the thing that increasingly our customers say they most appreciate about us is that we're giving them control over their energy. So a lot of what we're trying to do right now is to figure out how to embrace that and how to help people do it, but also, how to get credit for it and figure out how to get paid for it, right? Because you're absolutely right. It does not actually help us pay the bills by itself.
Right. How do you monetize that? How do the utilities, how can they be confident that you've actually created a savings stream?
That's exactly right.
Easier to measure it, so probably in the instantaneous, as opposed to sort of over the course of a year, right?
Well, we argue about the instantaneous enough as it is. So yes, when you expand it out to a year, it gets even worse.
I can imagine.
But you also listen to the real crisis people are having about the increase in their energy costs, the sort of lack of control they feel they have over those. And so even though we haven't figured out how to make any money on it, we hear loud and clear that that's what's needed. And we're trying to figure out how to provide a solution and do so in a way that doesn't undermine our business model.
Right. Maybe creates a new source of revenues to complement your what's been your core business model.
That's right. Yeah.
Let's go way back in your career. Born and raised. Are you California born and raised?
I am. I am a native Californian. I was actually raised in the country. I grew up just outside of Yosemite National Park, up in the Sierra Nevada. It's around 4,000 feet. And my family still has our home up there. My father and his wife still live there. And so I have watched, to some degree, the Sierra and our forests die. And that is a hard lesson to learn, and I think impacts this. You know, you most people live in the cities and you might see it's a drought or other things, but when you watch all of the pine trees die in a forest that has existed long before I was born, but that I grew up in, and then you watch it burn, it has a pretty big impact. And so I feel like I love it up there. It is still absolutely gorgeous. I go up there whenever I can, but it has changed a lot. And that change just over my lifetime, I actually feel like in some ways empowers or powers my efforts around climate change. It's hard to ignore.
Right. It's really interesting to see. You asked me why I enjoy these conversations. I mean, to hear what motivates people. That these are in your roots, no pun intended, but right. Your roots are in that, seeing that ecosystem go through a big change. You went to UC San Diego as an undergraduate, is that right?
I did. I went down, I went as far away from my parents as possible while still paying in-state tuition for university, and that was San Diego. So
that's so funny. I was living in New England, and I went as far away as possible. And so I went all the way from New England all the way down to I went to UC San Diego also.
Oh, I don't know that we talked about this before. This is great. All right.
Yeah, and then you went up to Berkeley.
I did my graduate program up in Berkeley a few years later, yeah.
And so by that time, were you really focused? I mean, that was public policy. Were you focusing in on energy environmental issues at that time?
Well, so in between those, I spent a few years in Washington, D.C., and I worked, eventually got appointed to the Clinton administration and spent a couple different jobs there. But the longest one I held was actually an aide to the United States Secretary of Energy. I didn't know anything about energy. And the very first project, or one of the very first projects I ended up on, was about the rollout and announcements related to refrigerator standards. And I went to Washington thinking I would work on exciting issues of world peace or maybe, you know, going to space, or I have no idea what. And I ended up working on a refrigerator standard, and I thought that perhaps I had made a poor choice in my life. But I actually think that was like my first true energy love. I think that moment, because what I learned about in that moment on refrigerators was that small changes that people don't even notice add up to such huge, big, important change. The refrigerator is one of the most incredible success stories of energy in history. The refrigerator has become, it uses like 90% less energy. They're 75% bigger. They cost a lot less. And a lot of that was work by government agencies and folks in California and others to sort of increase these standards and the industry to respond to those. And so nobody knows about this story because it worked. And so that's the great thing is, you know, you sort of learn about the stuff that's under the hood that people aren't paying attention to. And how do you get that right? And then a lot of success comes, even if no one really notices. They notice when things go wrong. Yeah. But this is one of those successes. And I don't know that I really understood how big that impact was on me of that first project until as I look back now and see that stuck with me in a way that seems pretty important. And so when I went to public policy, I was already very interested in environmental and other issues like this. And I really focused in on these issues. I mean, on some other things as well. And so as I came rolling out of my graduate program, it was definitely a focus to stay on environmental and energy related issues.
And then did you go directly to the city of Berkeley at that point?
I spent a few years working on political campaigns. I worked on a bunch of environmental measures and other measures and candidates. But again, I think the environmental piece was there. And some of those I look back on and maybe they weren't, in retrospect, they weren't the winning choices. I worked on a green diesel program. I don't know that in retrospect, that's one I would tout on the resume, but you know, each one of these, you learn, how does the industry work? How does automotive work? How do these buses work? How do these things, and how do you communicate this to people in a way that they're comfortable with? How do you deal with regulators? And so I spent a few years doing that. And from there, ended up at the city of Berkeley.
And you've been touted, you've been labeled as the godfather of PACE financing. I met you, I was working for the city of Palm Desert. We were rolling out PACE program and you were up in Berkeley. I guess weren't you originally using the Mellow Ruth's tax provision for, But basically, you became the leader or one of the great leaders of this whole new financing method. And what prompted your thinking about that? What got you going in Berkeley to that basically, I think the utility programs were not providing sufficient financing for folks, and you thought maybe you could put that on the tax roll instead. Was that the concept?
Absolutely. I mean, this is back in, the mid 2005, 2006, 2007 in there, Ted, that, and you and I were both slogging away in our working with cities, trying to figure out how to solve some problems. The issue that one of my favorite questions, maybe my favorite question that I've come to like embrace as like my career choice is, what problem are you trying to solve? Because it really illuminates when you're having a conversation with somebody what the challenge is. And so I can tell you, like, what happened back with Berkeley was I got fixated on a problem. And the problem was, at the time, we wanted people to do energy efficiency upgrades to their homes, and we wanted them to get solar, but it took a lot of money up front, and there really weren't options to pay for it. This was before solar leases and PPAs were available for residential customers. There was no such thing as a solar-specific loan. People could basically either write a check out of a checking account or use maybe a home equity line of credit. Those are your options. And so most people didn't have any access at all to financing for these projects that hopefully would save them a lot of money over time, but cost a lot up front. And so I was just working on how we would kind of open that door, how we would try and fix that. And so, yeah, I was looking at all kinds of ideas that didn't go anywhere. I was trying to figure out how to do utility, how to do things with utility bills. And, you know, PG&E and others said, you know, you can go just pound sand over there in the corner if you'd like. We're not going to do that. And I looked at a variety of other things, our garbage bill and other places that the city had, because I was looking at what tools does a local government, does the city, in this case of Berkeley, have that we could use to stretch out this payment, you know, to do something. And it was really by accident that I got pulled into a neighborhood dispute over a Mellerus financing district. And I don't remember much about the dispute, but I do remember thinking, wait a minute, we are allowing people to voluntarily choose to make an improvement that affects their home and repay it as a line item on the property tax bill. That feels like something we could work with. And that was the beginning. And as sort of I say with Pace, it was, I didn't invent Mellerus. I didn't invent a lot of things. I just was like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. I didn't invent peanut butter or jelly. I just kind of put the two together. I'm like, you know, this could be a yummy sandwich. And then out of that, Pace really started to get rolling and still is going today. But it was very much focused on how to solve a very specific problem that was bedeviling me as we were trying to roll out environmental opportunities in the city.
Right. And the brilliance, I think it's fair to say, is that you took Mellerus, which was a way for a community, as I understand it, to tax themselves to build, say, a public park or a fire station or something more sort of traditionally seen as a municipal sidewalks or what, something like that, or perhaps sewer lines or infrastructure. But you took that and said, wait a second, if you create a district and everybody agrees to it, then they could do things individually on their own homes, right?
You know, that's exactly right. So the recalling back the first, the start of this, the neighborhood financing district that spurred all this for me, they were actually doing an underground utility district. So they were taking the electrical equipment, the poles and wires, and they were putting them underground. And that, of course, has fire safety and earthquake safety benefits. Great. But it's also, you know, really nice, right? So these homes would have better views and you wouldn't have poles and wires in your front yard. And the city's perspective was, look, that's a lovely thing to do. And there's a public purpose for it with the fire safety. So we'll help you do it with this financing. But you pay for everything. The city's not going to foot a pen, not going to pay a penny of the cost of this improvement. I was like, well, if we're going to put all the poles and wires for the electricity underground, why not put them on the roof with a solar system? And if and even already with that initial law, you know, the amount that an individual property paid varied. It varied based on the amount of benefit accrued to that home. So we were already in a place where people were voluntarily taking a tax. They were voluntarily doing a project, and the amount they were paying was related to their benefit. And so it really wasn't a huge leap from there to say, you know, let's use that to finance clean energy and energy efficiency. It opened some new challenges, and we've obviously still deal with those, but it was, I was surprised nobody was doing it already.
Right. And they had those, you already had those California Assessment Acts. I can't remember, 1911 or 1913.
Been at it for a while. Yeah.
Sort of essentially set up to do that kind of a thing. Well, what we did in Palm Desert, obviously, and what you did in Berkeley started off being a municipal program. In Palm Desert, we raised all our own cash to do it, and we ended up using the PACE mechanisms, working with the county tax roll. But along the way, it became clear that there were some opportunities for third parties to jump in here and to manage these programs and to bring the capital for these programs. And that's essentially what Renew Financial did, which you went on to lead Renew Financial. And if you could gloat about it or brag about it, what would you say was your the great accomplishment there? I think you were there for almost 10 years.
No, it was 10. Look, I remember having a conversation with the mayor in Berkeley and talking about this idea, which became PACE. And he said, the problem is we have no money. So you got to find the money that's going to be used to finance these things. And I was like, well, where are we going to get the money? And ultimately, after a year or so of helping set up the first program and doing various things, there was still a challenge finding the money. I thought, well, this is an opportunity. There's a way that a company could do this. And so after I'd left the city and had played around with various ideas, I ended up helping co-found Renew Financial and then ran it for 10 years. I'm really proud of a bunch of stuff we helped kind of invent in that world. But the biggest thing that I'm proud of is that we financed projects in 92,000 homes. We got solar and energy efficiency installed in 92,000 homes in about 15 different states. And we financed $1.5 billion of projects. And we didn't just end up using PACE, although that was probably about a billion of it. And the company's still going strong. They're still out there. But we did utility on-bill financing, and we did the world's first unsecured energy efficiency project loan asset-backed securitization. It was also one of the smallest securitizations ever, but we did it. And that paved the way for all these other solar loans and things to come for after it. So we really were at the forefront of figuring out how to use financial mechanisms to democratize access to clean energy. And I'm real proud of that. And most, the 99% of those projects were great projects that got really great done. And, you know, and some of the projects weren't great, but we, I think, succeeded in our mission of really opening the door to the widespread adoption of both solar and more efficient improvements.
That's great. And you were also very much a spokesperson for PACE financing, going to Washington and testifying. I know you've had a lot of different roles where you've been the advocate that has not only helped your own company or Renew Financial, but helped the entire market. So thanks for all your work with that. Let's fast forward and get into your current company, which is Ohm Connect. You're the CEO. I know there was three gentlemen that had this idea. Maybe you could sort of talk about their idea, and then we'll take it from there.
Absolutely. So Ohm Connect is 9 years old now, and I've been the CEO for three and a half years. The reason I joined, the reason I got to know these guys, was I became focused in the last couple of years. I was doing financing at Renew Financial before I decided it was time to take on some new challenges. I was like, you know what matters now? Increasingly, what matters, the problem we have is not whether your home is efficient, it's when your home is efficient. And that's a fundamentally different problem. But if we're going to transition to zero carbon and renewable power, we need to be able to flex demand for electricity in the same way that we used to be able to dial up and dial down fossil fuel power plants, because power plants no longer have those same controls. So we need to, instead of the supply being varied, we need the demand for electricity to move around to reflect the availability and the price of electrical supply. And that it, not only do we need to do it, if we don't do it, and if we don't do it quickly, we're going to blow up the grid long before we get to zero carbon. So I am by no means the first person who had this notion. At this point, the world has seen enough of it that it's no longer a surprise when I say things like this. But a few years ago, I was thinking, who's doing this? Somebody's got to have tried to figure this out because it's so important. And if we don't do it, we can't get to zero carbon. This is just a threshold issue. And I looked all over the world and it turns out the company that was doing the thing that I thought needed to be done, and the only one I'd found who'd really cracked the nut, was 15 minutes from my house. And I didn't really know them. It was Ohm Connect. And it turns out that years prior, these incredibly smart folks had actually had this same idea way before me. And it turns out that the people who'd done it had some really important skills. One of them had been an energy trader when the energy markets first opened up to financial participants. So he knew how energy markets work, like CAISO and all these other things that now like undergird most of the US energy system, electricity system. And the second one was the chief technology officer of Zynga, who created, you know, Farmville and Words with Friends. And so all of these, so basically was the pioneer of social gaming, which, you know, may have been a total disaster for the universe, but was quite a thing that went from zero to, you know, billions of users. So he had left Zynga thinking there's got to be a way to put what we've learned about how to engage people to this energy problem and connected up with the guy who knew how, who was like, how do we get, you know, I know how the energy markets work. How do we get customers to do it? And so the two of them had spent years with a great group of other people coming together, Kurt and others, to try and figure out how to solve this problem. And it is non-trivial. As we know, it is hard to get people to do things about energy, but they figured it out. And so when I came along, they'd sort of figured it out in one market in California, but nobody really believed it because everybody from all the history of all these programs and utilities had felt like they're never going to work. And so a lot of what I did when I joined raising money was telling the story, was helping people understand in positions of authority, regulators and utilities and others, that this really works. You can get hundreds of thousands of individual customers, residential folks, to change their energy use all at once. And you can do it over and over and over again. And you can predict exactly how much energy is going to get reduced using a ton of data and analysis. And now we've proven it. But it was something that is really important to the future of the grid and to our transition to renewables. And I got very lucky in that I connected with these guys, I think right at the moment they'd cracked the nut and they needed somebody to help figure out how, what to do then. And I'd had some experience with that. So that was my foray into joining Ohm Connect.
It's a great story. And when you said nobody was doing it, I think nobody was doing it in the residential sector, right? The demand response had really been relegated to large users, right? For many years before that.
Yes, absolutely. So let me say, I think there's two things that Ohm Connect does that are different, and both are important, and you're absolutely right. The first one is it's residential, and residential's important because what we're seeing increasingly is residential, the peak moments, like in California, the famous duck curve, right? We peak. Not, it used to be at 2 in the afternoon. Back when you were doing demand response, right? It was 1 or 2 in the afternoon. We'd have these peaks. And that was because everyone was at the office and everything was going and all the industrial stuff was happening. The peak now is actually at 7, 8 o'clock at night. And that peak is 70% residential demand. So what's happening is everyone's getting home and turning on their air conditioners and TVs and everything else. And the solar comes offline at exactly the same time. So we have this evening peak. So that means residential becomes increasingly important just because that's what's on when we're hitting our peak. And that's different than it was 20 years ago. So we have 20-year head start in figuring out how to get residential and commercial folks to do energy efficient, to do demand response. And nobody had really thought that residential was number one, that important, or two, that easy. And it became not easy, but very important. And I think that's been the transition. So we've learned a lot from where things were in demand response years ago. The second thing that's important about residential too, that I think gets lost sometimes in the mix of all of this, is that it's actually you can do it all the time. Once you engage a customer, unlike a commercial enterprise, if they know what's happening and they're getting paid, they like it when you call more events because they get paid more. So commercial tends to be like, look, if you need to call me once or twice a year or once or twice a month at most, fine. But our residential customers have once they get hooked on it, they're like, wait, you haven't called an event in a week and I need some money. So let's go. And so they really switch gears. So we call events all the time. Customers will get 100 plus events a year. And so we become much more, we get used a lot more. Residential customers are comfortable getting dispatched a lot more. So I think those combinations have meant that residential's become an important component.
Yeah,
it's building off of the commercial side of things.
So let's run through like sort of how this works. You have your trader realizes that the energy markets that I want to talk about in a second need capacity, and somehow you send out a signal to people like me that have signed up for your service. And do I get that via a text or email or both or a phone call, or how do I take action as one of your members?
So let's talk about California. We're now in multiple states and countries, but in California, where we are the largest residential demand response program in the state, and I think we are the largest residential virtual power plant on earth. We have 215,000 enrolled, engaged California customers. And here's what happens. We, 10,000 times a day, we tell the state's grid operator exactly how many megawatts we have and exactly where we have it and at what price we'd need to get paid to make those megawatts of demand reduced on the grid. And when our price clears in their mechanism, we are required, and we have between 15 minutes and 1 day notice, depending, we are required to reduce that energy use as much as we've been dispatched or face the same penalties a power plant would face for not producing when dispatched. We then signal our customers, and we do that in two ways. Number one, if we have enough time, we'll send you text messages and an email, and your app will tell you, hey, look, here's how much energy you normally use at this time. Please use less, and we will reward you and pay you for the difference between what you usually use and what you use in this event. But increasingly, what we also do is we connect to your devices and appliances. So we actually control, in California, 300,000 appliances and devices in people's homes. These are everything from smart plugs to, of course, smart thermostats to EV chargers and hot water heaters and refrigerators, and you name it, we probably control it. And so when our customers have trusted us with is, not only do they have the ability to turn things down, but they said, go ahead and do it for me, and you don't even have to warn me. So we will just reach in and actually change the setting on your thermostat or turn off something for 15 minutes or an hour. So we do that at scale, and we can do that at a hyper-local basis all over the state, or we can do it system-wide in times when the grid is really in trouble. And so those are the two main ways we engage people. And then afterwards, we then say, great, you succeeded. Here's how much you reduced. Here's how much you've been rewarded. Go forth. You can get yourself some gift cards. You can buy some stuff in the store. You can cash out on PayPal, whatever you want to do. So we've really made it both easy to participate, and we've automated that process. And that's taken both a lot of work, but also just a lot of developing trust with people, because that's a lot to ask people to hand over to us.
Yeah, it is. It's fantastic. It's a brilliant model. Congratulations on it. And what would a typical, not that everything is all about money, but what would a typical homeowner make in the course of a year if they were one of your participants? I mean, is it a matter of a few hundred dollars? I mean, is that sort of in the range?
Yeah, you definitely can. So first of all, I would say, unfortunately, it almost always is about the money. And so even though people love the environmental benefits, I think you and I both know, like that only gets you so far. Yeah. The economic benefit is what drives people's participation for the most part. As we say, they do it for the money. They tell their friends about it because they're proud of the environmental benefit. So you got to have both. People who participate get benefit in two ways. The first is how much we pay them. And our best users make several hundred dollars a year just in direct payments or rewards. But you also, our average new customer reduces their energy use, as I mentioned, about 7%. And so when you look at that across like PG&E, well, we're actually talking about a $200 to $300 a year reduction in your energy costs because of that reduction in use. So you're getting both the ability to make some money from us, but actually the bigger benefit increasingly is that you're actually saving some money on your bill. And as I mentioned at the beginning, that is more and more a focus for individuals,
yeah,
and a focus for us in trying to help figure out what to do about that.
There was you had a case study that was developed, I think it was August 14th of 2020, and maybe there's been other ones, but where Ohm Connect was, we really proved the value in shoring up the grid. Is that right?
Yeah, so our first big test was August and then September of 2020, where we showed up with a lot of megawatts, actually hundreds and hundreds of megawatts to reduce demand right at a time when the grid was starting to fail. We had our first blackouts in a long time in August of 2020. And I think actually our success during that period of time, I think got a lot of attention from regulators and leaders. They're like, wait a minute, this could work. So then flash forward to September of last year. And we have California faced blackouts again. We had the highest demand ever recorded in our grid. We were gigawatts short of supply. And we engaged our users over a several day period as much as we've ever done before. We dispatched them in all kinds of different ways. We gave out gift cards and whatever else. We were able to reduce 1.6 gigawatt hours of energy use across that several day period. And we're one of the key reasons we didn't have blackouts was because our customers stepped up so broadly and so well. We paid our customers $2.7 million just during that small period of time, because that's how expensive and valuable the megawatts were on the market. So we were able to translate not only a huge economic benefit to our customers, but we were also able to deliver this great benefit to the grid. And that, I think, proved that what happened in August 2020, where we sort of showed up for the first time and, you know, was not a fluke, that we can do that. And that, in fact, our customers show up the most when the grid is at its worst. And that's a really powerful thing to have in your back pocket when you're managing the grid.
Final couple questions. You've got the major utilities here in California, San Diego Gas and Electric, Southern California Edison, PG&E on board with Ohm Connect. I believe you're working with Consolidated Edison in New York City. Where else are you? You mentioned you're even in a couple other countries now.
Yeah, so we launched in Texas. We are available anywhere that the competitive market exists in Texas. So all of ERCOT. And we've been growing a lot there. And that has been great. I think it's great, too, because one of the things I love about all this is it's not political. You don't have to have an argument about policy or climate change. You just say, like, do you want to get paid for managing your energy a little bit? And people, it doesn't matter whether you're blue, green, or purple, you like it. The second is we launched a couple years ago in Australia with our partners Origin Energy there. And we have 100,000 customers. And it's going great. It really is both a powerful tool, and they're seeing exactly the same benefits there, which is you have dispatchable megawatts, but you also have people engaging around the energy. 81% of our customers in Australia say that they have changed how they use their energy all the time because of the program. And that's just teaching them a little bit about what's happening in the energy. So those are really exciting places. We'll be launching Canada later this year.
Boy, congratulations, Cisco. Congratulations to you and your colleagues. How are you maintaining a healthy balance in life? You're looking good. I know you've got a son who is into baseball. I think it's baseball.
Got two of those. You know, obviously the kids keep you grounded. It's been wonderful to have that experience as they've been growing up and getting older and doing all that. I don't have a great answer to this question. I was thinking about this the other day. I run, and I don't really like running that much, but I like having run a lot. I like when I'm done running. And you can run anywhere, anytime, and I just need a pair of shoes. So I've started running half marathons. I run a couple, three a year, and it just makes it, I sign up for a half marathon, and then I know a few months from now I have to be ready to run 13 miles or I will embarrass myself in public. And so I keep myself fit, be out of pure public shame, fear of public shaming. And I feel like that is my way of keeping myself emotionally and physically healthy. And I feel much better having gone for a run. Usually, like today, the day after a half marathon, I don't feel great. I feel pretty sore, but I feel like I accomplished something. And that is really key. It's also a time where I think a lot, right? When you're running, your brain sort of slows down and chews on things differently.
Oh, great. Well, whatever it takes to get you out there. But yeah, I've always found, I think you're probably just like me. I've always found that you always feel better after you exercise. You always feel like, you know, it's tough to get yourself out the door sometimes, but always feel better. Well, listen, Cisco, thanks so much for all you've done with PACE Financing and now with Demand Response and Ohm Connect. And it's really been great to catch up with you. Have a great day.
Thank you, Ted. It's been great.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.